We have many questions, and so I will begin and I'll address the questions to the individual participants as we proceed. I'll start with Lewis. The first question is, if you were president, what would you do?
I'm just glad I'm not president. I'm the amateur citizen, as Paul Weaver just said. And I have no idea what I would do if I was president. I would be seeing the situation from a completely different perspective and presumably with a lot better information.
Second question, also for Lewis, is what was your opinion of Al Gore's speech?
You mean the recent speech?
Yes.
I didn't hear Al Gore's recent speech, so I don't have an opinion.
Al Gore gave a speech yesterday in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club that was basically calling into question many of the issues that the panel was raising. And
I'm at a disadvantage because I didn't hear it and I didn't read it this morning, so I don't know what to say.
A question for the entire panel is, what should we make of Homeland Security? You want to start with Alan?
I think it's just, it has such a Mussolinian sound to it, doesn't it? You know, we're on guard in the homeland, and we will make it secure from evil thoughts and witches and wizards and other things that go bump in the night. And if the things that are bumping in the night are phantoms across the world, then we'll have to mold and exaggerate our perception of them. They failed on 9/11. These guys are the ones that were supposed to be protecting us, and instead of any heads rolling, they all got promoted and reshuffled around on the deck of the Titanic. That's absurd.
Homeland Security means for me mostly a new form of color coding of our daily security. And I'm at a disadvantage because I'm colorblind, so I can't tell.
Well, I guess Homeland Security gets back to how you define security and whose security it is. And that should be open to debate.
I guess I have two thoughts. First, when you look at its origin and the way it began, it was pretty clearly an exercise in media politics. The White House needed to do something to put out an image of doing something fast and dramatic, and this looks fast. It was fast, and it looks dramatic. So on the one hand, I want to say it looks like a pretty much empty gesture. On the other hand, let's not underestimate what happens in Washington. They make all these dramatic and somewhat empty gestures, but real money and real power are eventually assembled in their names. And then someone gets his hands on the power and the money and turns it to some objective, often not the one originally intended. So I don't think we really know what Homeland Security in practice is going to mean, but it could mean something significant. We don't know what it is. It might not be good.
Our next question is also for the panel, and the question is, how can we deter future terrorists? Alan?
Well, let's see. I mentioned rethinking American foreign policy. I wrote it at the time. We never should have sent the troops into Saudi Arabia in the first place. we should have taken them out not because Osama bin Laden was kvetching about them, but because they didn't serve American interests. And we need to reassess American interests and what they really are, and whether some of the things that we've been doing for years and years and decades, you know, all those bases in Germany and South Korea and Okinawa, I mean, are they helping us to deter terrorism, or are they stirring it up? The questions need to be asked. Get spread out. You know, they like these centralized things. So the more we decentralize America, the better we are.
I think, first of all, we recognize that terrorism is a crime. It's not something you wage war against. You wage concerted, organized, and cooperative police action against it, which means you try to maintain international cooperation rather than shifting the whole subject towards regime change and getting the rest of the world mad at you. Secondly, you do, as many of us have pointed out, you do rethink policies that are counterproductive in that they don't achieve any of your core values, but do anger millions of people around the world and thus lend aid and comfort to terrorists, whatever their particular motives may be. And you don't finally deter terrorists necessarily. You do fight them, but you fight them wisely and not by. I might just make one other point, which is, if you notice where the huge increases in the military budget are coming, many of them are coming in things like new stealth bombers and weapons for fighting a new Cold War that have nothing at all to do with the alleged threat out there. And so finally, you don't waste precious national resources on threats that are irrelevant to the problem at hand.
Well, certainly through fair and equitable foreign policy that doesn't seek to topple other people's governments and lead to blowback. And perhaps a certain amount of terrorism is unavoidable, and in those cases, we can protect against it through well-trained, well-funded, and accountable law enforcement agencies. It really comes as no surprise that the FBI and the CIA don't have informants in the Middle East. They don't have an adequate number of translators. If you've been covering federal courts over the years, you know that the FBI doesn't even have enough translators to transcribe tapes in mob cases or organized crime cases involving crime groups of different countries. So that's something that could have been fixed a long time ago.
I don't know about terrorists, or terrorism, but we certainly were attacked by a group of specific terrorists. And that problem we should be doing something about. We should be responding. You can't stand by and be attacked, just as the police department can't stand by when people are murdering folks on the street. So that's the part of the response that I think is important, and I'd like to see it done more aggressively and with better focus.
A question for Lewis. Why do you think there's more opposition in the British Parliament and public than here?
I think there's more a tradition of political argument and dissent in England. And Tocqueville, when he comes to the United States in the 1830s, is surprised at how reluctant the Americans were to engage in free expression. I mean, they had it in their constitution, but in practice, they were often afraid of going against what he referred to as the tyranny of the majority. And I find the same thing here. And when you look at the question period on C-SPAN in the Parliament, you see the rather fierce exchange of idea and opinion between the members of Parliament, and you don't usually see that in our Congress, and you don't really see it in our press either. And I would attribute it to our sometimes too sensitive not wanting to hurt each other's feelings. And on September 11th, when they were doing the Remembrance Day in New York, that was the theme of the whole day. Everybody must be made to feel comfortable. And we tend to do that. I once had a television show, and we'd have guests, and I'd have guests and panelists who would say that they would come on and want to argue with each other on some point, and in the green room they'd be very fierce in what they were going to say, and then when they got out in front of the camera, they all became very polite and circumspect. I just think it may be a national trait.
Sort of a follow-up question in reference to the quote that you had from Krauthammer. The questioner is asking, how close do you think we are to the Lord Acton quote, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely?
Well, I think Acton's right, and I think power does corrupt, and we get these naive notions of Krauthammer, the sense that we can do as we will with the world. I mean, you read some of the Policy Institute papers that back up the neoconservative foreign policy positions, and people talk very blithely about. I read one a couple of months ago where the people were sitting around a conference table in Washington and thinking that maybe they would drop an atomic bomb on Afghanistan, not for any specific military objective, but just to demonstrate to Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt and other countries in the Middle East what sort of thing could be done. I mean, it was a very fantastic discussion. And that, to me, is a form of corruption when you get divorced from reality and think that you can do as you will without some form of international cooperation or some understanding of other people.
Another question for the panel is, what's the relationship of oil to this issue?
I'm not going to say much. I think there's some relationship. What strikes me is that we talk about cheap Middle Eastern oil, and we never count the cost of all the military forces that are deployed in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. Years ago I did a column that tried to estimate all those costs and what a gallon of oil or a barrel of oil would cost in those terms, and I can't remember the numbers, but it's a fantastic number if you take all the costs into account. So it can't possibly be for cheap oil, because the oil is not cheap and it's about to get a whole lot more expensive. So I must say that I'm kind of mystified. I think it's a power game in which oil is a tool, but I'm not sure oil is the big thing.
Well, in 1991, you may remember, President Bush Sr. at one point was asked about why we needed to go to war, and he said basically it was to protect our vital oil supplies. Very quickly, he changed tune and said we were just intervening against Iraq to preserve democracy in that part of the world. And from that point on, right, so much of it, from that point on, we stopped talking about anything as concrete or as messy as oil. But sure, oil is a big factor. It has been from day one in our policy in the Middle East, going back to the 1940s. I mentioned the coup that we sponsored in 1953 in Iran following the government's nationalization of the Foreign Oil Consortium. The following year, the State Department oversaw the reorganization of a new private foreign oil consortium in which the United States had a very large interest. The 1963 coup in Iraq followed that government's partial nationalization of Foreign Oil Consortium. It's been a huge interest of the United States. It's been a huge interest in recent years as the United States has played a huge chess game trying to dictate the laying of oil pipelines from the Caspian Sea and from various countries in the former Soviet Union all over South Asia. There was a period of several years when the United States supported the Taliban regime because it was considering an oil pipeline that would go through Afghanistan to be built by UNICAL. And the current member of the National Security Council, who's the expert on Afghanistan, was UNICAL's Afghan representative and lobbyist on that pipeline project. So yes, oil is a very important factor. The reasons are complex, both for economic reasons. Even if the cost of acquiring the oil exceeds the value of the oil, as Alan put it, there are particular interest groups who benefit from access to that oil who have a disproportionate impact on our foreign policy. So they've socialized the cost of getting that oil and they privatize the benefits.
Well, to the extent that oil is a factor in our foreign policy and perhaps a negative factor, it does raise a question that is not discussed very much anymore, which is, what is the country doing to make itself less dependent on oil?
And I would add only the thought that mostly what we're talking about is cheap oil. Remember, in America, a gallon of gasoline costs well under $2. Everywhere else in the world, it costs 2-3 times that much. And what a lot of our diplomacy is aimed, not at supplying or at stabilizing supplies of necessary oil, but at making sure that we can drive enormous SUVs for a tiny fraction of what we probably really ought to be paying to run them. That's the part of this that troubles me more than that we're defending national interests in oil. That, it seems to me, is an appropriate aim of policy. But defending really cheap gas, that's dumb.
A question for Lewis is President Bush using the military focus of the United States to carry out a family vendetta against Iraq?
I don't know the answer to that question. I can't read into the head of Bush. I'm told by people that know him that there is a vengeful streak in it, that he genuinely feels that Hussein is a villain who must be destroyed. And apparently there is a angry hatred of Hussein, but where that comes from, I don't know. I don't know whether his father gave it to him or what. I don't know how he comes by that. I don't trust the kind of journalism or history that reads into other people's heads. I do think that I think Bush is a true believer, I mean, like Ashcroft, and they are both equipped with a messianic spirit, which I think is dangerous no matter where it shows up, whether it shows up on the side of an Arab jihadist or an American evangelist. I'm always wary of the messianic spirit. I think Cheney and Rumsfeld are cynical. And who?
Wolfowitz.
I don't know. Wolfowitz seems to me to be a zealot of some form, with some won't say crazed idea, but the some visionary notion that I think is probably very unrealistic. I'm not sure what the basis of the unreality is.
Question for Jonathan Marshall is, isn't massive retaliation against one's enemies the only course to take?
I guess it depends on what the enemy has done and who the enemy is. If there's an enemy that's identifiable and threatening your life or the life of your country, potentially so. But first of all, I think it's incumbent upon us, and certainly part of all the rules of war that we claim to subscribe to, that we not massively retaliate against the entire civilian population of a country, so that we try to narrowly target our force and use force only when truly necessary. I think the grave danger of the new Bush foreign policy is its messianic thrust. And instead of, as a great many conservative realists, people like Brent Scowcroft, even Henry Kissinger, who are not exactly liberals, have warned against this notion of preventive strikes against real and imagined potential future dangers. As they pointed out, if every country started practicing this kind of foreign policy, it would be deadly anarchy. It would be kind of worldwide bloodbath. This is a radical foreign policy that's being engaged in, not a conservative foreign policy. And I think, therefore, what we've done, we're going out in search of enemies rather than really trying to protect true national security.
A follow-up question that's related for Jonathan is, what actually is the story about nuclear weapons in Iraq?
I'm really not an expert on that. I gather that both the report that Tony Blair released today in Parliament from his own intelligence sources and the recent report by the International Institute for Strategic Studies both concluded that this is not a prime threat. The big problem for Iraq is getting fissile material, i.e. Uranium or plutonium that's processed. And because they don't have a reactor and apparently have been unable to acquire this in at least large enough quantities, most experts that I've read and know about don't think that this is an imminent threat. It doesn't mean that if he didn't get it, he probably could put a bomb together fairly fast. He probably wouldn't be able to deliver it by a missile any place of consequence. But of course, today the problem, despite our billions of dollars spent on missile defense, the real problem is, of course, you could bring a weapon in just in a freighter and blow it up in New York Harbor. But sure, I wouldn't deny that there is a long-run threat that Hussein, left to his own devices, could get access to weaponry. But I would point out that the country that most recently acquired weapons of mass destruction, i.e. nuclear weapons, was Pakistan, which is now our great ally. And personally, I'm much more concerned that some terrorist will bump off Musharraf and some intelligence zealots who are fundamentalists will take over the country, and we will have a bunch of crazies in control of nuclear weapons. I think we all ought to be much more concerned about that than what Saddam Hussein is up to right now.
Another question for Lewis. What is your view of the imperial presidency and presidential war powers?
Well, I would be opposed to the imperial presidency, and I would like to see the war powers granted in the way they were supposed to be granted by the Constitution, which is to say by the Congress. Very straightforward answer.
Another question for Lewis is, why do you think Tony Blair is so slavishly or slavishly a supporter of Bush's war policy?
Well, I don't know. He is also a twice-born evangelical in the same way that Bush is. So there is this Christian notion of crusade somewhere in Blair's thinking. But otherwise, I don't know.
I have a sort of a quick comment. As someone who considers himself a Christian, it's really hard for me to find a whole lot of endorsement of preventive war, preemptive war, and even a whole lot of war at all in anything that Jesus said. It's certainly been used over the centuries in ways that have had a lot more to do with the immediate power advantages of those who were calling themselves Christians at the time. And the church has certainly been a very human institution in that it has plenty of flaws and faults, and tends to breed sometimes at various times in history people with sort of megalomaniacal notions, but I don't find in the Gospels a whole lot that would give much aid and comfort to Wolfowitz or Ashcroft or Tony Blair.
Yeah, they are presumably readers of the Old Testament.
Another question for Lewis is, considering the lack of dissent over many of these measures, which are obviously dramatic changes, and the lack of debate, generally speaking, over these dramatic changes, what is your view of your being attacked by the Americans for Violence, or Victory Over Terrorism?
I didn't know that I'd been attacked by such a group.
That's it's the group that Bill Bennett and others have.
Oh. Well, I would take that as a normal course of events. I mean, if that is the Bennett, Cheney, Alumni Trustees Council crowd in Washington, they are very rabid supporters of the war on terrorism. And they came out with a report shortly during the fall of last year in which they quoted 150 university students, professors around the country, and accused them of being disloyal for saying very bland things, such as, I can't remember, they were so bland. I mean, people would say, war is not good. And that was enough to prompt an attack from Bennett on the ground that was somehow a disloyal remark. I mean, the observations were of that character.
Last question. Oh, you have something? John?
So the audience knows, Lewis was referred to by Bennett and Americans for Victory Over Terrorism as an internal enemy. So that we now have a Nixon-style enemies list, and Lewis will be able to wear this as a badge of honor.
Wow.
Last question. These questions, by the way, many people are asking similar questions, and here's another good example, what can the average American do to learn more about what's going on and do to affect these policies? And it's Director Lewis.
Well, you read and write. I mean, as Paul Weaver would say, there are lots of ways of getting better information. I mean, there are magazines, there are websites, there is the foreign press, the news. I mean, the news is not something that is necessarily given to you. I mean, it's something you have to make and participate in and form your own idea. Democracy is the hardest possible form of government because it requires a high degree of literacy and it requires paying attention. So it's not only informing yourself, but then trying to take possibly political action. Maybe you run for office. Maybe you stage a complaint, or maybe you start a magazine, or there are all kinds of ways of trying to express one's opinion and objection. And one of them is this kind of a crowd in this kind of a room tonight.
I want to apologize for not being able to get to all of your questions. There are just many, many excellent questions. But I think this evening we've started, hopefully, a discussion and more. On behalf of the Independent Institute, Harper's Magazine, the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I want to thank all of our speakers, especially Lewis Lapham and our panel, for their excellent presentation. Before you all leave, I want to remind you that Lewis will be in the outer lobby autographing his books. And for those of you who don't have copies, I urge you to get a copy. We look forward to you joining with us at our next event.